From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young at the DNC in Philadelphia. It's Here and Now, and it's the day after. History made last night, Hillary Clinton becoming the first woman to be nominated by a major party to be president, speaking to the convention from New York on a huge video screen here in the arena.
If there are any little girls out there who stayed up late to watch, let me just say, I may become the first woman president, but one of you is next. Thank you all. I can't wait to join you in Philadelphia. Thank you.
And standing there on that floor and joining us now is NPR's campaign reporter Asma Khalid. Hi, Asma.
Hi, Robin.
Your overall impressions of last night?
So, I mean, what we heard there at the end from Hillary Clinton, to me, is just so clear that last night was really about showing that this was a historic moment, not only, you know, for Democrats, but for the country. And I think this feels so different than the campaign we saw Hillary Clinton run 8 years ago, where gender was not always at the forefront. You know, not only did Hillary Clinton appear via video message, but how she did that was so powerful. It came at the end after a series of these black and white portraits of all the former presidents, all of them men. And then there was sort of a virtual glass ceiling that was shattered, and we all saw Hillary Clinton. So I think that was kind of the main message that Democrats were trying to portray yesterday.
Yeah, not holding back on that at all. And let's hear some sound from a voter we heard from this morning, Amanda Atkinson from Philadelphia, talking about last night.
I am so excited to have a woman who could be president, and I have four sons, and they're six and under. It's amazing to think that the only president they might know is a black man and a woman, and that's incredible.
Yeah. And Asma, you've been covering the demographics of this election. That's your beat. About 100 years ago that women got the right to vote. But this could be tricky because there are voters who feel that she's pulling the woman card.
There are. And look, I mean, there were some scenes of, I guess I could say, unrest, folks unhappy yesterday, particularly from the Bernie Sanders camp. After Bernie Sanders unanimously put the nod for, you know, by acclamation, supported Hillary Clinton yesterday, and she became the official nominee, some of Bernie Sanders supporters staged a walkout. They walked out of the arena and, voiced their concern that she did not represent some of their main priorities. That being said, some of them stayed, and I talked to. So I think, you know, within the contingency of Bernie Sanders supporters, even there are some folks who say that they are never going to vote for Hillary Clinton. But then there are also people who acknowledge that, you know, she was not their first choice. They don't necessarily see themselves canvassing for her, but they'll vote for her. And I think that her job over the next couple of months will be to see if she can win over a number of those Bernie Sanders supporters, and many of them are young voters, and, you know, she'll need them come November.
Well, and I want to talk a little bit more about Bernie Sanders. We've got a great moment teed up here for us to talk about. But before that, what about Donald Trump? I mean, obviously she's aiming at those women who might ordinarily vote for the Republican candidate as well.
That's right. And polling does show that Hillary Clinton is doing better with white women in particular than Barack Obama did 4 years ago. You know, it's worth remembering, as much as we think of women as a Democratic voting bloc, Barack Obama actually lost white women by about 14 points in the 2012 election. Hillary Clinton seems to be shrinking that margin. And some analysts I've spoken to repeatedly tell me that, you know, the traditional Democratic gender gap that we think of in elections could potentially turn into a gender gulf. So in that way, you know, Donald Trump does not seem to be making or doing himself any favors with women. That being said, Robin, I do think that there will be some very interesting demographic trends to pay attention to as we move forward, particularly white men and white working class voters. Both of those groups seem to be at this point leaning more towards Donald Trump.
Yeah, and we hear from women all the time who say, well, wait a second, I'm a woman and I'm also leaning toward Trump. So, you know, as always, you can't just talk about a whole block of people, but percentages of them. And I do want to get to this great moment yesterday, a little overlooked. During the roll call, as the different delegates and delegations cast their votes, Bernie Sanders' brother Larry cast a vote for Democrats Abroad. That's a group. And he talked about their parents and the TV cameras turned to Sanders. I haven't seen him this emotional. Let's listen.
They love the New Deal of Franklin Roosevelt, and we'd be especially proud that Bernard is renewing that mission. It is with enormous pride that I cast my vote for Bernie Sanders.
What was that like on the floor?
You know, I think it was an emotional moment. There were a number of Bernie Sanders supporters who cast their votes that you know, expressed emotion for him. But I think maybe one of the most powerful moments after that was when Bernie Sanders himself got up to give Hillary Clinton the official nod and try in some ways to unify the party behind her as the nominee.
Yeah, well, see, here's Brother Larry, who lives in London, by the way, which is why he's part Democrats Abroad. That was a little moment there. Real quick, got about a minute here, Asma. What about, we talked about women and Londoners, but what about the young voter bloc?
Yeah, so Robin, I spent a good chunk of yesterday on the floor and in the hallways of the arena interviewing younger voters. This is a demographic that overwhelmingly supported Bernie Sanders, according to the exit polls, but they are a demographic that seemed to lean left. So I will say, you know, I got mixed reactions. I talked to some folks who say that they will never vote for Hillary Clinton. But what I think is interesting about this demographic is it is the most diverse generation to date. And I spoke with some Latinas, some African-American voters, some Muslim voters who told me point blank that whether or not they love Hillary Clinton, they feel like being Bernie or bust is a point of privilege that they just can't afford with Donald Trump on the other side.
NPR campaign reporter Asma Khalid. We'll continue listening to what you find. Asma, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, the big news in Philadelphia this week is obviously all about the convention. But Philly's a great American city, so there's a lot going on. And soon you'll be able to hear about it on any of the city's three new low-power FM radio stations. These independent stations will have modest wattage and only reach certain sections of the city, but they will feature a lot of neighborhood-based content, such as What's Life Like After Prison? Erin Moselle from Here and Now contributor WHYY sat down with the woman who's producing that program and has this report.
So that's you. You're going to introduce that topic? Okay.
On a recent Wednesday, community radio activist Vanessa Graber is directing the foursome behind the People's Paper Co-op Radio, the multi-segment show on WPPM. The vibe of the show is a bit like The View or The Talk, but less polished and without all the celebrity gossip. The program will reach residents downtown, but also several surrounding neighborhoods. The goal is to do a monthly live show, but on this day, the group of former inmates is recording episodes that can air once WPPM is up and running in September.
What does being a strong woman mean to you right now, Faith?
Being a strong woman means to stay focused, remain humble, remain teachable. Being a strong woman means being independent to me, holding my own. My mom always told me, ain't nothing like your own.
Faith Bartley is in her early 50s. She's rail thin with tight cornrows and an easy smile. She's been out of prison for nearly a decade now. She started selling drugs after serving in the Army. Crack, marijuana, PCP, anything she could get her hands on. Then she started using.
I never stole anything from my mom or my family members, but I stole their sleep. She used to send my brother and sister in the crack houses I used to be in. I used to hide behind the door and say, don't tell them I'm here. I'll give you $2. Don't tell them I'm here. And being in the crack house, $2 meant a lot because you're $3 away from getting another piece of crack. You understand what I'm saying?
Bartley says things didn't change until her mom died. Then, and only then, was she really ready to start a new chapter.
My mom's remains are cremated on my mantelpiece next to her mother. So every day I reach over in their box and I pray. And I say, girls, I'm going out there. I'm going out there. I'm going to do the right thing. I know you girls are proud of me. You know what I'm saying?
The radio show is another thing that fuels Bartley these days. It keeps her on track. She says it's empowering to have a platform to reach women like her and draw on her life experience to do so.
Who better to speak about recidivism, about being in the penal system, about coming home trying to start all over again and find myself back in it? I'm an expert at that, you understand? So now my expertise lies in the fact that I want to help women.
Michelle Scales goes by Miss Me on the air. Like Bartley, she did time after being arrested for drug trafficking. Now she lives in a halfway house.
And I went through detox at Presbyterian Hospital. So overall, I've been in treatment for 11 months.
Not surprisingly, that period hasn't been easy. Scales says doing the radio show helps.
It's like when you have a sinus cold and you're all clogged up. It's like when I go in there, it's like I can breathe.
And she's feeling like a new person.
I see a lot more in myself than I ever seen in a long time. Like, I know I have potential to do anything that I put my mind to, and that's been so hard for me to say or to fathom in such a long time, because I thought I was going to die high.
For community activist Vanessa Graber, that's everything. Not only does she hope the show inspires listeners, she thinks recording the programs will prove how far Scales, Bartley, and the others have come.
Hopefully these women will be in a house like the one they dream of, you know, and, you know, that moment in time where they were struggling, you know, is recorded and in history, so they can, like, look back on it and reflect and kind of see it as a sign of growth.
And perhaps encourage other women ex-offenders to speak up and do the same, even if it's one listener at a time. For Here and Now, I'm Aaron Moselle in Philadelphia.
It's Here and Now. In Philadelphia last night, there were strong chants of Black Lives Matter, often through tears, as the mothers of the movement took the stage. These are nine black mothers who lost children in different violent ways. Geneva Reedville, the mother of Sandra Bland, who died in jail after being pulled over at a traffic stop, was the first to speak.
I am here with Hillary Clinton tonight because she is a leader and a mother who will say our children's names.
Say our children's names. Well, tonight the convention will address gun violence, with families of the victims of the Orlando nightclub shooting set to speak. But as Democrats exercise their right to speak out in favor of gun control, one young black man in Philadelphia is calling for African Americans to assert their right to own a gun and know how to use it. And he's found an ally in an alley in Philadelphia. On a small side street in North Philadelphia, you can hear muffled gunshots. This is the gun range, the city's oldest operating shooting range and teaching facility. It's small but packed with customers in stalls on the other side of thick glass, some experienced with high-caliber rifles, some beginners taking aim with light handguns at paper targets, and on this day, no African Americans.
Hi, guys.
Robin.
Hi, Robin. Really nice meeting you.
Do you have your rear blocks in?
Yeah, okay. I keep them nice and tight. I want to.
Yuri Saltzman owns and runs the gun range and points out some of the clientele.
Two Jewish women. There's an international couple, Southeast Asian. Two American couples. Here's a father with three of his four daughters.
And so what are you saying?
Well, watch.
It's family sport.
Well, no. Just you can interpret it how you want, but it's more than family sport, okay?
So what is it? Well, Saltzman says about 12,000 people come every year, ordinary people, but also police officers, firefighters. He says more than 60% of all the customers are women, and that many are mostly interested in guns for protection, as he was growing up in Israel during the Yom Kippur War. And as Gil Kanan is now, he's a member of Fun Gun. That's a shooting club for the LGBT community. And it's not always about fun.
I was being followed by some people who were making some aspersions about me, and they were following me to my vehicle. So I waited till my vehicle was between me and them, and then I indicated to them that I had a firearm, at which point they very promptly went away.
And you're not worried then in that situation you'll be overpowered, your firearm taken, that you'll be less safe because of it?
That's why I waited for there to be a car between me and them.
He was trained to do that here, and his gay shooting club hopes as word gets out that they might be armed, that will be protective. And by the way, the club started before Orlando. Maj Ture hopes his club will do the same thing. It's called Black Guns Matter, no relation to Black Lives Matter.
Black Guns Matter is an educational group that deals with firearm training and safety in the urban community specifically.
Maj is a member of the NRA. He grew up in North Philadelphia witnessing gun violence and believes the solution is more gun education. He says it's the people's choice and a right.
Well, for one, they should choose to exercise anything that's going to defend themselves. If someone has a firearm and you don't, you lose. That's it. No different than if someone has a knife and you don't have a means to defend yourself, you lose. So I think that in the community that I'm from, I think that information is deliberately, kept away. It's made to seem as if you have a firearm, you're either law enforcement or you must be the bad guy. And no one can deny with, you know, the things that have happened over the last few weeks. We're being murdered by law enforcement and in our own community at alarming rates, you know.
let me ask you about that. I'm wondering if any of the events of the past have maybe changed your mind. Look at Dallas. You had a very peaceful Black Lives Matter protest with several blacks carrying their long rifles. And then when a shooter started, the police were looking at them as if they might have been with the shooter.
Well, that's the police officers and law enforcement's responsibility to balance that out. And I also wouldn't say, because there's one or two or a few bad apples, I wouldn't say throw the whole bunch out. You know, you cannot group and have a monolithic statement or a blanket solution for everyone when people don't fall in alignment with that particular, you know.
Well, and you've answered my question. Dallas does not change your thinking at all, just on the level of confusion.
Absolutely. Well, I don't even think it's a level of confusion, and that's law enforcement's responsibility to be better trained and execute, you know, their duties in a much more productive way.
But Yuri, staying with Dallas, the reality that there was confusion, the police even tweeted out the picture of a young black man carrying a long rifle that they thought might have been with a shooter. He was not. Mm-hmm. But then also there was the obvious illustration of how when people are able to buy these military-style rifles, those cops, dozens of them, were armed, had guns, and needed a bomb to take him down. The guns did not work.
Well, what we're talking about is one additional very unfortunate, tragic event. We don't normally have these situations. So I think that the discussion should not take place on the fringes, no more than it is pleasant to have a conversation with somebody whose thoughts are at the extremes one way or the other. What Maj and I are doing here is we're creating synthesis that is based on the reality of what an everyday American experiences in a big city. And a big city is not a peaceful place sometimes.
Just talk about guns for protections, right? There were a little over 250 justifiable homicides in 2012. That is, people who the courts ruled were justifiably defending themselves. However, there were 232,000 guns stolen. There were 1.2 million violent crimes, and none of them were stopped by guns. There were 20,666 suicides with guns, 8,342 criminal homicides with guns. Maj, doesn't that give you pause?
How many were with knives? How many of them were with legal, trained, informed, by legal, trained, informed citizens? These are the questions, because, I mean, you know, those are horrible statistics, but at the same time, what we try to do is inform and educate people to make better decisions. I also think that there's no way to really quantify someone who feels more safe and is more safe in those high-crime areas.
So is it more about a feeling than a reality?
No, it's not about just a feeling. Feelings are second to facts all the time. You know what I mean? But you can't quantify someone, and that those are the stats that are always left out, it seems. We try to ignore the fact that this particular single mother, this particular, you know, senior citizen protected themselves. Those aren't sexy sound bites. So we leave those away. You know what I mean?
It's an undocumentable event. Right. If a gun in a situation became a deterrent, there's no agency that says, come to us and tell us when a gun was a deterrent.
But going back to the 250 justifiable homicides, there's almost double that of accidental shootings, and many are children. You know, I mean, and it's not just in African-American neighborhoods. You know, we've seen the mothers in the SUV and the little kid in the seat behind it gets it. I mean,
Well, that comes back to, that's one of the major reasons why we as an organization are here at Black Guns Matter. It's about education and training. No one's going to disagree that education and safety training, the NRA has a great program called the Eddie Eagle Program, which trains children what not to do when they come across a firearm.
Like, don't even touch it.
Don't even touch it. Get an adult. These are simple things that in certain demographics, we just go around it. We act like it's not here. We act like it's not a part of American culture, and that's improper.
Maj, what about Philando Castile? Legal gun owner, African, young African-American. We don't know what happened there, but we've all seen the video, and it seemed as if he did everything right, at least from what we saw in the video. Are you comfortable arming more young men who might be stopped by police who might not be trained and educated to know how to deal?
Well, it's not about arming more African-American men. It's about informing more people. The other thing is, I think that one officer handled himself improperly. And just like, I don't want to be hit with a blanket statement because I'm a young African-American male with tattoos and, you know, things like that. I'll never make a blanket statement about law enforcement because of, you know, those officers. But that does indicate a certain level of training, maybe psychological evaluation. In order to get the license to carry, you have to pass criminal background checks, your mental health in certain places, depending on where you are. I think that every so often, certain officers that have those type of things on a record should meet that same type of requirement. You know,
look, we're here while the Democratic Convention is here. Is there anything you'd want to say? It's the Republicans who have more backed gun rights. It's the Democrats who have backed gun control. Mm-hmm. Is there anything you'd want to say to the candidates or the delegates?
Well, what I can say to the American people from whatever background you are is exercise your Second Amendment rights. Look into it. Be open-minded, be objective, and learn. You know, because, you know, a lot of people say, you know, well, the Republicans have backed X, Y, and Z. And even that part is flawed. You know, Dr. King was a staunch, nonviolent person, but he was a Republican. I'm a Republican.
How do you feel about Donald Trump, the candidate?
I don't think about Donald Trump for candidate. I don't. I think about my community. I think about getting more people to come to the gun range and exercise their Second Amendment rights. I think about politics being local and then spreading out to influence candidates. You know what I mean?
That's Maj Touré, founder of the group Black Guns Matter. We also spoke with Yuri Zaltzman, owner of the gun range in North Philadelphia. And by the way, yes, I shot a Ruger Mark III handgun, .22 caliber. Yuri insisted I try. It turns out I'm a pretty good shot, but I was aiming at a big outline of a milk bottle on a huge piece of paper. A milk bottle. That was fun. It was like cap guns when you were a kid. I hit the target. But had it been the shape of a person, I'm not sure how that would have gone. We'd love to hear from you. Your thoughts on Maj Touré's insistence that if African Americans in the inner city arm themselves and learn how to be around a gun, they will be safer, and it is their constitutional right.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be made in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
Amazon drone delivery may soon be coming to the United Kingdom. This week, the company announced a partnership with the British government that would expand tests of unmanned delivery drones. The tests will go beyond what's currently allowed in the United States, even under new regulations released this year. Those regulations came amid concerns from pilots that drones pose a danger to airplanes. Last year, researchers at Virginia Tech did a simulation that found that when a drone was sucked into the plane, to the engine of an airplane, it could lead to engine failure. So let's look at all this with Samuel Burke, business correspondent for CNN Money. He's in London. Hi, Samuel.
Hi there.
So first of all, this idea of plan for testing drones in the UK is part of Amazon's Prime Air program. Can you first tell us why is this going forward in the UK?
Well, a lot of people think that really Amazon is turning to the UK to kind of put pressure on the United States government and say, hey, they're letting us test different types of ways of delivering goods in the UK, so you guys better step up and do it. For instance, they're going to let them test line of sight, or rather out of line of sight, so a pilot doesn't actually have to see the drone. Now, in the United States, that can't happen. Also, they're going to be able to test at nighttime. So this is just a pilot program right now. There's no delivery, but a lot of people believe that delivery will come to the UK before it does in the US, and that's a big step for an American company to do something outside the United States.
So Amazon is hoping to use drones that weigh, what, less than 55 pounds and could potentially deliver packages in a half hour. I mean, are there some other regulations as this test program goes on? Because I'm wondering about, you know, aviation concerns have been a big deal here in the United States with pilots of regular airplanes saying we don't want drones in our airspace.
Well, what I hear time and time again from drone makers, from the people who work with drones, they do have those concerns. And keep in mind, you have to have a drone, an actual pilot's license to actually fly a drone. So what they say is, look, of course we have concerns. I don't want to be in an airplane, but they feel that maybe some of the coverage has been sensationalized in the United States. So this really gives Amazon and maybe some other companies to test out these different approaches, not have to worry so much about regulation. I also have to tell you, I speak with a lot of Chinese drone makers. Usually you think of Chinese tech companies as copycats. They're now number one in the world. Manufacturers like DJI, for the same reason, because they say they're able to work with the Chinese government and get more done than they could in America.
Now, just to be clear, we're not talking about Amazon testing these drones, say, where you are in London, right?
Exactly. They made it very clear that this will only be in rural and suburban areas, in part because companies like Amazon, they're already good at delivering products within 30 minutes in Manhattan. They really want to get to customers that are out of reach right now, and that would be with the drones in farming areas, for example.
Now, insofar as the UK testing, is there a timeline for the testing program?
Well, they're going to get started here shortly, and some people are saying that it could start happening as early as next year. But remember, this is just a pilot program in the UK, and that's what they've been doing in the United States, and it hasn't taken off, so to speak. So we have to wait and see. But I think there's a good chance that this could be coming soon. They also say Canada and the Netherlands are other places that could come before the United States.
Well, Samuel Burke is business correspondent for CNN Money. He's also an anchor at CNN Espanol, and he's speaking to us from London. Samuel, thanks so much.
Have a great day.
It's here now at the Democratic Convention in Philadelphia, and now that Hillary Clinton is the first woman ever nominated to be the presidential candidate from a major party, we wondered what hopes people have if she wins the election and how her administration might be different from President Obama's. So we sent Here and Now's Alex Ashlock out to ask.
She certainly has more experience. She seems to be a very pragmatic, grounded person. So if she is elected, absolutely, you could see that she might take the baton from President Obama and lead the way. I think she has some different initiatives and some same initiatives, in that regard.
I think we need to improve the healthcare system even more. I think we need to make it more readily available for everybody. Obviously, I'd like to see a single-payer healthcare system. I don't know if that's going to be possible. And in terms of international relations, wouldn't it be nice if we were not at war anywhere anymore? So I'd like to see that happen as well.
Any thoughts?
I would really agree with the healthcare system. I would like to see more progress in that area, and I would like to see the Supreme Court get finished, or, a nominee confirmed, and I would really like more gun control.
They talked a lot last night about her work overseas to support women and girls and survivors of trafficking, and really just the way that she lifted up a lot of those public issues. And so I would like to see a continuation of that, supporting women and girls globally as well as here in the States. And here especially, I have a concern for paid leave, paid maternity, paid paternity leave, paid family leave. I think that's such a critical issue for so many of our working families here in the U.S., and I would love to see that happen in the next administration.
I'm not as much as concerned with the politics. I'm more concerned of just seeing at least another 4 years of diversity, fresh thinking, and people thinking outside the box, keeping the great things that is about our country, and expanding more on how good this country could really be.
Curtis Tate, Ramana Yakiyama, Amanda Atkinson, Karen Smith, and Grace Sharoni speaking to Here Now's Alex Ashlock in downtown Philly this morning. Well, inside the Wells Fargo Center tonight, President Obama, Vice President Biden, and Virginia Senator Tim Kaine, Hillary Clinton's running mate, will speak. So what is the view from the party about how it's going so far and what the Democrats need to do going ahead? Illinois Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, first elected to Congress when Bill Clinton was president, joins us now. Welcome, Congresswoman.
Oh, it's a thrill to be with you. Thank you.
And how do you feel it's going so far? Big bump on Monday.
Michelle Obama was extraordinary on Monday, I thought, in particular, although Bernie Sanders was great. What I loved about Bernie was not only that he was clearly saying, I'm supporting Hillary Clinton, but he was also saying, and do not not vote. You need to come out to vote, because turnout is going to be the answer to our victory.
Well, it's so funny you mentioned Michelle Obama. You were thinking of bump as in a good thing. I was thinking of bump as in bump in the road with the email scandal.
Oh, I was thinking bump.
I know.
I'm thinking good.
I was thinking pitfall, perhaps I should have said. It feels like a long time ago, but we're hearing people like Donna Brazile, who's the temporary head of the DNC, saying there may be more emails. Do you think that the Democrats have been able to put that scandal behind them, the fact that the DNC was shown to be supporting Clinton over Sanders?
You know what? I think that there may be some backlash because of the Russians having leaked this or gotten this, hacked this.
You know, the Washington Post is reporting that the Russians, the FBI had gone to the White House, the FBI headed by a Republican, had gone to the White House even before this and gone to the party to say the Russians are hacking the DNC.
Right. And so I think it is clearly an effort on their part. I mean, Vladimir Putin, I think his endorsement for president would be Donald Trump. They're really good pals, it seems, that Trump really admires Putin and the kind of strong man that he is. So I'm not sure that that'll be a big thing. I really do think that Michelle Obama and her amazing talk from a personal mom level about the bully and the name caller that Donald Trump is, I think will actually resonate with a lot of women, and then, of course, Hillary Clinton being a woman. So I think she did us a lot of good on Monday.
Well, and go through the rest of the week so far. I mean, we're just at Wednesday, but yesterday you and other female representatives joined House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi on the stage to highlight issues like equal pay for women, affordable health care, women's reproductive rights. You're the first elected to Congress in 19... You were first elected to Congress in 1998, as we said, during Clinton's second term, at a time when just 12% of Congress was women, and now it's 20%.
Yeah, well, it's still a little low. We're Democratic women, 65% of the 435 altogether, 108 women in the House. So we do need more, but we are certainly making progress. And the number of candidates that the Democrats have that are women would really expand our numbers. I think this could be another year of the woman, certainly at the top of the ticket. That'll help.
Obviously, people on the other side think it will be the year of the woman, but the woman is Ivanka Trump. As you know, she got up to talk about women's rights at work, other things that resonate with women. Donald Trump, has been in support of the good things that Planned Parenthood does, is what he's said. And that was...
Who knows what he believes? And certainly his platform is just horrible and much more reflective of Mike Pence, his
VP.
Running mate,
yeah,
as vice president, who is the most extreme of all the governors, one of the most extreme members of Congress when he was there, beginning the fight with Planned Parenthood in 2007 to try and defund them. And that's the kind of policy that's reflected in the platform and that their base wants to hear about.
Look, last night we heard from people who told incredible stories about how Hillary Clinton has supported them for decades through terrible trials, like 9/11, for instance. We saw a parade of people from law enforcement and people who were injured on 9/11 talking. I mean, just incredible stories about how she'd stuck with them. But you know, polls show that she's one of the most disliked candidates, along with Donald Trump, ever. And also there's a perception, huge perception, that she is not trustworthy. He uses the word she's a crook. What do the Democrats do about that?
Well, first of all, this has been a 30-plus year campaign against Hillary Clinton, who has always bounced back and done what needed to be done to make sure that we get health care for children. I mean, all of these things were enumerated. But the personal kindness and friendships, I think, was really a good positive. Because if you ask people, what is it about Hillary Clinton that you don't like or don't trust? Well, it's very vague. Whereas Donald Trump, who gets on the stage, wants to be president of the United States and demeans Mexicans and immigrants and Muslims and people with disabilities, there's no hiding that. This is a bully. And that's what Michelle was talking about. Do we want this person as a role model? Extract all issues and say, is this the kind of person that we want to lead our country and the world?
But I have to say that there are some people who can give you a list. I mean, they point to the DNC scandal that we just saw, and they draw that back to her own email problem with the servers and her spanking by the FBI chief, who said that she was careless with emails. They take it back to investigations when Bill Clinton was president. They take it back to rumors about whether or not she had something to do with Vince Foster, a former friend's suicide. There is this feeling that it feels like it needs to be overcome.
And that's why starting Friday when we leave here, it's going to be about not only getting the message out, but getting our people out to vote. I think there are enough people to elect Hillary Clinton who believe that she will be a great president if we get them registered and get them out.
Yeah, and those some minds may not be changed. We only got about a minute here, Congresswoman, but she's perceived as a hawk. That may be good in these serious times, but there are some who still resent that she voted for the Iraq War, which she's apologized for. How would you characterize her on foreign affairs?
Experienced. I mean, she knows every single leader of the world. Donald Trump has zero experience. Let's remember, this is a choice between two people. Donald Trump said he's not sure about NATO. Maybe we shouldn't be supporting NATO. Are you kidding me? Hillary Clinton's the one.
Illinois Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky. Feel your party's doing pretty good this week?
I think we're going to have a great bump, a positive bump this week.
Not a bump in the road, a good bump.
Not a bump in the road.
Congresswoman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
63 years ago today, a truce on the Korean Peninsula.
Tonight we greet with prayers of thanksgiving the official news that an armistice was signed almost an hour ago in Korea.
That's President Dwight Eisenhower announcing the Korean War Armistice on July 27, 1953. Some 5 million soldiers and civilians died by the time the armistice agreement ceased fighting in Korea. And technically, though, the war is not over since no peace treaty was ever signed. And the effects of those ongoing tensions are obviously inescapable in both North and South Korea, but also on American foreign policy ever since. Jim Walsh is with MIT's Security Studies Program and is Here and Now's security analyst. He joins us now. Good to see you, Jim.
Good to see you.
All right. So first of all, Jim, you've studied this region extensively. We wanted to take this moment to sort of just ask you, when you think about the past 63 years and the effect of the Korean War, what are some of the things that you think about?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think about the American men and women who served in that war. People like my father-in-law, Hollis Nichols, still alive, involved in a brutal and terrible war, one that sort of gets lost in the collective memory, sandwiched between World War II and Vietnam. Mm-hmm. Doesn't really get the attention it should, but incredibly important. And as you think about that span of decades, really, it's a story of a rising South Korea from a backwater to one of the biggest economies in the world. And in terms of security, going from a situation where there, both sides were looking for war, particularly the North Koreans who initiated it, now to a very different place where neither side wants a war, but where the danger of nuclear weapons hangs in the shadows.
I was going to say, there's still a sense of belligerence inescapable.
Absolutely.
On the peninsula. But so remind us, let's just take a moment here to remember what triggered the war and the U.S.'s involvement in Korea.
Well, that's a matter of some historical debate, whether statements by Truman encouraged the North Koreans to attack. But it was the North Koreans who did initiate the war. I think most people would judge they had been planning that since the end of World War II. So they march down the peninsula, take over more than 90% of South Korea, really South Korea hanging on a thread. When U.S. allies and others in the United Nations intervene, and back and forth, up and down the peninsula, that war went up and down, where the front line was constantly changing. And again, a war that was more than a million people were killed, more than a million battlefield deaths occurred, and atrocities and a lot of other terrible things.
Yeah. And some of the milestones that you see of the war itself?
Well, the amphibious landing at Incheon goes down in history as one of the great military maneuvers. Probably MacArthur's miscalculation in thinking that he could cross the Yalu River and China would not respond, which they did, again, causing another dramatic change in the war. I think, those are the two things from a military standpoint. Not much in those days. Remember, we are just 5 years out of World War II, right? Both countries were already decimated by, one, a Japanese invasion, and then secondly, the liberation itself was a battle as well. So it was a peninsula in tough shape, and then suffered a an intense three-year war.
But Jim, this is actually exactly what I wanted to get to you with, because as you pointed out, 5 years after the end of World War II, just 1950, but the United States doesn't declare war. It's a military action, right? And we're obviously very different from what was declared in World War II. And this is something that the U.S. then goes on to repeat several times through, you know, all the way through to today.
Yes, and you can imagine what the American people, what their sensibilities were like 5 years after World War II. I don't think they were really, chomping at the bit to get involved in another land war in Asia. And the U.S. in that mode was thinking much more about NATO, much more about Central European Front and the threat that Russia posed to Europe. So really, Truman had to, enter into this without necessarily all the political support of all the lawmakers and the American public opinion.
You know, I take your point about the service of the soldiers, the U.S. soldiers that fought in Korea. But also there's, aside from that, there's sort of a debate over military missteps and civilian leadership in terms of how the United States performed in the Korean War. But I have to ask you, we're talking about this in the last minute that we have, 63 years after that armistice was signed, and there's still all those tensions on the peninsula. It makes me think about conflicts the United States have been involved in ever since. I'm thinking of Iraq specifically. Are we in a world where the United States is getting itself involved or triggering conflicts and wars which will have unending consequences for half century later?
Well, I think wars tend to have long-term consequences, but I would distinguish between treaty alliances. The U.S. has three big treaty alliances, NATO, Japan, and South Korea. That's sort of a different thing than Iraq, which was a war of choice, one that could have not been taken. But we are obliged, and for good reason, we're obliged to protect our enemies and to make sure that they don't go off on their own in a rogue way. So I put that in a different category.
Well, Jim Walsh is MIT's Security Studies with MIT's Security Studies Program and Here and Now's Security Analyst. Jim, thanks.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. Here and Now.